Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 27, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call, as today we discuss CalPERS versus ANZ Securities. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back to Teleforum Mark Chenoweth. He's General Counsel, Washington Legal Foundation. First of all, Mark, congratulations. I know your brief was cited in the majority opinion. Congratulations on that. But
thank you very much.
You're welcome. You'll give us some background remarks and then talk about the decision. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please be thinking of your questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Mark Chenoweth, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and I should say, in case I forget by not saying it right away, that WLF's amicus brief in this case was authored by Lyle Roberts and some of his colleagues at the Cooley firm, and so although WLF writes most of our own amicus briefs in-house and obviously supervise all the briefs that that go out under our name, lots of credit goes to Lyle and his team at Cooley for this particular amicus effort. But let me talk about the CalPERS case. CalPERS v. ANZ Securities grew out of a class action lawsuit brought against a host of underwriters for securities offered in Lehman Brothers back in the 2007-2008 timeframe. You may recall that Lehman Brothers famously went bankrupt in September of 2008, sparking much of the panic around the financial bailouts and the onset of the so-called Great Recession. The class action lawsuit was filed against the underwriters in late 2008, alleging that the registration statements for the Lehman Brothers securities contained material misstatements or omissions in violation of Section 11 of the Securities Act of 1933. In February of 2011, CalPERS, that's the California Public Employees Retirement System, the largest pension system in the United States, CalPERS brought its own separate suit against the underwriters in the Northern District of California. That suit was transferred to the multi-district litigation pending in the Southern District of New York. Soon after that, a settlement was reached on the class action suit and recognized that CalPERS was a member of the class. At that point, CalPERS opted out of the class action suit and wanted to continue its own litigation. The respondents then moved to dismiss the lawsuit as time-barred under Section 13 of the Securities Act. The district court agreed with the respondents and dismissed the suit. The Second Circuit then upheld that dismissal, and the Supreme Court ultimately granted cert in this case, presumably to address a circuit split between the Tenth Circuit on one side and the Sixth, Seventh, and Second Circuits on the other side regarding whether or not Section 13's three-year time bar may be tolled under the Supreme Court's 1974 precedent in American Pipe and Construction Company v. Utah. And tolling, in case you don't know, is the ability to temporarily suspend a statute of limitations, often for equitable reasons, to allow a suit to go ahead and proceed that might otherwise be time-barred. In what was apparently the first 5-4 decision of this Supreme Court term in which Justice Kennedy wrote for the traditional conservative alignment of himself, Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Gorsuch, the court upheld the Second Circuit and did not toll the statute of repose. As Justice Kennedy said at the end of his opinion, the final analysis here is straightforward. Quote, the three-year time bar in Section 13 of the Securities Act is a statute of repose. Its purpose and design are to protect defendants against future liability. The statute displaces the traditional power of courts to modify statutory time limits in the name of equity. Because the American pipe tolling rule is rooted in those equitable powers, it cannot extend the three-year period. Petitioner's untimely filing of its individual action is ground for dismissal. So that's a pretty brisk summary. So let's slow down and unpack that a bit before looking at the implications of the decision. First of all, the holding of the court is that Section 13 is a statute of repose, and the court decided that for four reasons, beginning with language and text, then looking at structure and purpose, then moving on to history and precedent. Unlike a statute of limitations, which runs from the time a cause of action first accrues, a statute of repose runs from the last culpable act or omission of the defendant. And the statute here says, quote, in no event shall any such action be brought to enforce a liability created under Section 11 more than 3 years after the security was bona fide offered to the public, unquote. Because the three-year time bar runs from the last act of the defendant, the court construed it as a statute of repose. In fact, the court said under its prior CTS v. Waldberger precedent that, quote, this point is close to a dispositive indication, unquote. In other words, any statutory time limit that appears to be attached to the last act of the defendant, as opposed to when a cause of action accrues, is likely going to be determined to be a statute of repose going forward. The next factor that the court looked at was the structure and purpose. And here the court noted that there's a pairing in Section 13 of two different time bars. There's a one-year statute of limitations, and then there's this three-year time bar. And I won't quote the statutory language on the one-year statute of limitations, but suffice it to say that the court recognized that if there's already a one-year statute of limitations in the statute, then this three-year time bar has to be doing something else. And the court explained that statutes of limitation and statutes of repose frequently are found together and they work in concert, and that this is an additional reason to believe that this three-year time bar was a statute of repose. The court next looked at the statutory history, the legislative history, and found that that also supported the view that this is a statute of repose. It didn't spend a lot of time on that, but noted that Congress had first adopted a longer statute of repose of about 10 years, but soon abandoned that and shortened it to the current three-year time limit. The court also then noted, almost in passing, that it had described Section 13 as establishing, quote, a period of repose, unquote, in its 1991 Lampf, Pleva, Lipkind, Prupus, and Pettigrew versus Gilbertson case. Looking then at the text and the structure and the history and the precedent, the court said, you know, this is a statute of repose. And once the court had determined that Section 13 is a statute of repose, the case was pretty much open and shut. The court held that statutes of repose are rarely subject to tolling. It mentions that a statute might contain an express exception as one example of a time when a statute of repose might not be absolute. And the reason for this is that statutes of repose, the entire purpose of them is ending liability, and tolling would undermine that legislative purpose. So a question might still arise about whether some sort of general tolling statute might apply to a statute of repose, because that would be one legislative instruction aligning against another legislative instruction. But where equitable, meaning judge-made, tolling is concerned, the court held that a statute of repose, quote, supersedes the court's residual authority and forecloses the extension of the statutory period based on equitable principles, unquote. In short, then, statutes of repose may not be tolled equitably, and that's an important holding. Thus, the equitable tolling principles of American Pipe, on which the petitioner's argument rested very heavily, was deemed utterly irrelevant by the court. The court went into some detail explaining the logic of American Pipe and kind of cast a little bit of shade on it by noting that the court there had not gone into a careful discussion of the principles behind equitable tolling, but it nonetheless recognized that American Pipe was an instance of equitable tolling, but refused to apply it here because this is a statute of repose and not a statute of limitations. The petitioner had a secondary argument and argued that the class action complaint itself made its own complaint timely. The court did not buy that argument either. It noted that these were separate actions, and that the petitioner's logic would completely undermine statutes of repose by preventing a defendant from calculating its liability. If any time someone has been a member of a class action, they can opt out, and then years later they can bring their own action, then that proves too much, and that would completely undermine the statute of repose. I should note that even though Justice Ginsburg, writing for the four dissenters, accepted the American pipe tolling argument that petitioners offered, even the dissenters have a footnote saying that they would limit the ability to file your own action until the time when the class action ends. So they wouldn't want that to go on forever either. A couple of other points that the petitioner tried to make. One was that its right to opt out of a class action would be eviscerated if the statute of repose came into play. The majority said, no, that's not true. You just have to be timely in your opt-out, and that there's nothing about having the right to opt-out, nothing about that due process right to opt-out that allows you to avoid the statutory time limit. And the fourth argument that petitioner made was that it would create inefficiencies to enforce the statute of repose. And the court did not agree with that either and said, quote, the court lacks the authority to rewrite the statute of repose, unquote. So notwithstanding any inefficiencies that might be created, the court was not willing to go against the legislative instruction here. Two more points to make about the inefficiencies point. The court notes that the Second Circuit has had this rule in place since 2013 and has not seen the kind of influx of protective filings that the petitioner was trying to predict would be a calamity here. The petitioner also had a kind of retired judge's amicus brief that made the case that if you enforce the statute of repose, you'll have lots of members of the class filing their own lawsuits before the statute of repose time period just in order to ensure that they can opt out later. And so what the court said is, well, gosh, we're not seeing that in the Second Circuit so far, so we're a little skeptical about the likelihood of that. The second point about inefficiencies that the court makes, and this is where it cites the WLF amicus brief, is that there's a process already in place to protect plaintiffs' interests, and that therefore it's not as onerous as the petitioner claims. You don't have to file your own separate action in order to protect your opt-out interests. It's possible within the context of the class action itself to preserve your rights to bring a later action, and you don't have to file an entirely separate prophylactic suit in order to do that. So because of the not seeing any concern with the inefficiencies there, that wasn't going to sway the court either. Now let me turn to the takeaways from the decision. I think the first one is that this ruling, by upholding the statute of repose, should put a stop to the holdout leverage problem. What is the holdout leverage problem? What do I mean by that? There's a cottage industry in securities class action litigation in particular of boutique plaintiffs law firms that approach a lot of these institutional investors like CalPERS. And as the class action settlement negotiations are continuing with class counsel, these folks will go to some of the biggest folks in the class and say, hey, if you opt out at the last minute, we can get a better deal for you than the rest of the class will obtain. And that's true. If they do opt out, they can do that. And so that has created a problem for the remaining members of the class, who then are subjected to an extension of negotiation sometimes, or there's an unfairness inherent in that because the one party is getting paid more than the other members of the class just because it has undue amounts of settlement leverage. And that was something that the court recognized in this decision. It doesn't say that was a basis for its decision, but I can't help but think that recognizing that holdout leverage problem at least balanced some of the inequities that the petitioner was claiming on the other side of the balance. The second takeaway here is that this decision will affect statutes of repose in many federal statutes across the federal code. It will not just be limited to the securities law. even though this is a statutory interpretation case in one sense, it's also a case about what's the difference between a statutory of repose and a statute of repose and a statute of limitations, and is there going to be an ability to toll that statute of repose? There's nothing about the logic of this decision that can't cross-apply to other areas of federal law. And the last takeaway I want to mention, and I need to credit Ronald Mann for this point in the nice article he wrote about this case at SCOTUS blog last night, that the court seems to be avoiding case-by-case equitable judgments about the timeliness of litigation. And he mentioned the SCA hygiene case from earlier this term and one other case for the idea that whether it's latches in the SCA hygiene case or whether it's a statute of repose here, that the court is trying to get away from having these case-by-case equitable determinations about litigation timing and instead is really shown itself willing to enforce the statutory limits, whether they are in favor of longer time to bring a lawsuit, as was the case in SCA hygiene, or whether it shortens the time in which you can bring a lawsuit, as was the case in CalPERS v. ANZ Securities. So perhaps I should leave the discussion there and open it up to questions, Dean.
Terrific. Thank you so much. We'll open the floor in a moment here. We'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question on the board. After that, our lines will be wide open. Let's now take our first call of the day.
Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick here in D.C. Two quick questions. The Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Employment Discrimination section, has a requirement that a charge be filed with EEOC within 180 days of the last act of discrimination. Historically, that's been treated as a statute of limitations. It sounds like there is an argument from this decision that it is a statute of repose. So that's my first question. My second is, there's a body of employment discrimination law that's called the piggyback rule, where someone else has filed, for example, a class action or another timely charge or complaint raising the exact same issue, and along comes someone else who is otherwise untimely but is allowed to piggyback for the purposes of limitations on that other person's earlier case. It sounds like also from this case that the piggyback rule is in serious jeopardy.
Bob, let me take those in reverse order. I would agree with you that the piggyback rule sounds like it would be in jeopardy, and I'm not familiar with that. Employment discrimination is not an area of law that Washington Legal Foundation practices in, and my own prior familiarity with that law is limited. But there is good language in this opinion explaining why, at least in the class action context, the filing of the class action is not sufficient to preserve the rights of every member of the class for a separate lawsuit, even if it's brought on identical claims. And what you're talking about in the piggyback rule would be someone who would, I think, be bringing something that maybe not be identical, but would be pretty similar claims to the timely filed suit. And in CalPERS, the court is saying that in the class action context, that doesn't work. And so I would agree with you that that rule might be susceptible to a challenge based on the logic of CalPERS. And that's not something that had occurred to me, but that's an interesting question that you raise. As for Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, again, not an area that we practice in. I agree with you that 180 days of the last act of discrimination sounds more like a statute of repose rather than a statute of limitations based on not just what the court says in the CalPERS case yesterday, but also what was said in the CTS v. Waldberger case a few years ago. And so I guess I would suggest that folks who have more expertise in the civil rights area might want to take a look at that, but I don't want to hazard a guest there because it's really outside my area of expertise.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are now wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me make a quick commercial announcement, as it were, about our next scheduled telephone conference call. That's tomorrow at noon at this same number. We'll be talking about yet another Supreme Court decision from yesterday, Murr versus Wisconsin. That's tomorrow at noon at the same number. We do have now another caller with another question.
Hi, this is Andy Urko in Los Angeles. Excuse me. How do you see this decision affecting state both enforcement and regulation in the securities area?
Oh, in the securities area. Well, I haven't thought about that. I don't know. I mean, I think that the rule in terms of the statute of repose would apply the same. But there are other cases in the pipeline that I think will, could affect that state question a lot more than this one. I don't think that that was really implicated. Now, there was a case, and let's see if I can – I don't think I'm going to be able to put my finger on it quickly enough for these purposes. But there was a case recently in which the Supreme Court said that the federal – that a federal environmental statute did not supersede a state statute of repose. There was a federal preemption argument made in that case, and the statute of repose won out. So if you take that ruling on statute of repose and you combine it with this ruling on a statute of repose, I think that there's a pretty robust treatment for that at the Supreme Court level. And so to the extent that any state litigation that you're looking at intersects with statute of repose, I would expect similarly robust treatment there. But I don't want to venture a broader guess as to the implications on any state securities litigation.
Yeah, just wondering what your opinion was on it. Actually, I think it's a good decision, but in any case, we'll see what happens in California. Thank you.
Well, yeah, and California is the place where a lot of the cases are arising from, where it looks like the state is trying to allow some kinds of securities litigation that should properly be in federal court. So I think that the Supreme Court will be visiting that question, if I had to guess, within the next term or two. But I don't think it's directly implicated here.
Thank you.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we wait to see who might ring in. Let me ask you a question, Mark. The decision came out just yesterday. I don't know if you've had a chance to read the dissents, but you mentioned in your opening remarks this was 5-4. What were the dissenters? What was their main sort of analysis, if you could talk about that for a minute or two?
Sure. Yeah, the dissenters really just, and it was Justice Ginsburg writing the dissent for Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and they the dissenters just really bought the argument that American pipe tolling should apply here, that the essentially that the defendant, by virtue of these plaintiffs having been in the class action lawsuit, was already aware of who they were and what their liability claim was and what the amount of that claim would be, and so that it wasn't unfairly prejudiced by this later filed litigation. And so the four dissenters argue that this is not the kind of repose that a statute of repose is meant to give to a defendant, and so they would have, they would have been willing to allow tolling here. A couple of points about that: I don't think that that the dissenters, I think part of what that means is that the dissenters don't think that a statute of repose is trying to get at the opt-out problem. They talk about the fact that folks like CalPERS can opt out of litigation at the last minute and you know, get a better monetary settlement. And there's no trace in the dissent that there's anything wrong with that. And in fact, that seems to be something that that they will treat as sort of a normal part of the process. And I think that that may be an unspoken or underlying difference between the majority and the dissent here is whether or not the opt-out leverage problem is something worth curing, or whether it's something that I think it would be hard to argue that the legislature had that in mind in the 1930s when this statute was passed. But it's certainly the case that enforcing the statute as written has the additional benefit of tackling that problem. But if you don't see it as a problem, which the dissent does not, then maybe that does infect the way that you view some of these other arguments.
Did the dissenters, but once again to the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone, or lines are wide open. Did the dissent go so far as to say this is not a statute of repose, or this is a statute of repose, but this is not sort of the circumstance where we shouldn't toll?
Right. So they agree. I don't remember whether they agree explicitly that it's a statute of repose, but they don't take issue with that holding. It's more that they don't think that this is what they say is, this is quoting Justice Ginsburg now, a repose period assures a party who might be drawn into litigation that if no action is brought within a specified time, he will be off the hook. But whether CalPERS stayed in the class or eventually filed separately, respondents would have known within the repose period of their potential liability to all putative class members, unquote. So I feel like the view of Ginsburg and the dissenters here is just that, well, this might be a statute of repose, but you already had all of the benefit that the statute of repose was supposed to give you. And if we read this as broadly as the majority wants to read it, we're giving you some additional benefit that the statute of repose didn't really mean to give you. There's also a different concern in the dissent over what the practical implications are. They seem to give more credence to the amicus brief filed by the retired federal judges. The dissent talks about how it should be incumbent on class counsel in the wake of this decision to notify class members about the consequences of failing to file their own claim. So what happens now, and there's some statistics quoted in the dissent about class certification and what percentage of times the class certification decision comes after the statute of repose would have already run. It looks like it's in, according to the study cited in the dissent, 36% of cases the class certification decision comes 3 years after the filing of the complaint. And obviously the filing of the complaint that would be more than 3 years after the last action, obviously. But in any event, the dissent is arguing that in a huge fraction of cases, then when you find out that you're a class member, the statute of repose is already going to have run and you're not going to be able to file a separate suit. And so the argument is that the district courts should superintend this, and that class counsel should have to let folks know that if they opt out, then they don't have, there is no opportunity for separate recovery. And that might be right. I think that it would certainly be wise for class counsel to do that in the future, but I don't view that as a particularly large burden if they're having to provide notice anyway, just to make that observation that the statute of repose has already run, and so that this is the only train leaving the station seems like a perfectly, not just a reasonable thing, but something that might be in class counsel's own self-interest to make folks aware of that. The other thing that Ginsburg's dissent says is that the majority's ruling will gum up the works and create an incentive for defendants to slow walk discovery and other pre-certification proceedings so the clock will run on potential opt-outs, unquote. And that may also be true, that there is some incentive there. But given how long these cases tend to be taking anyway, at least in the securities context where this three-year time bar is the one that's of interest, I have a hard time believing that any incentives on the defendant here are going to change the outcome very much. I mean, a huge fraction of these cases already are experiencing delays, and I just don't think that you're going to see a whole lot of different outcomes as a result of strategic behavior on the part of defendants.
You mentioned, we do have one caller question, but let me follow up on this really briefly if I could. And by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. You mentioned at one point in your remarks that this case should generalize to other statutes of repose. And when I think of statutes of repose, I think of the product liability, that, you know, the idea there is that a manufacturer of some product ought to there should be a hard and fast time limit. If they produce something 50 years later, somebody can't be injured by it and then claim a defect, or maybe even 11 years later or 10 years later, whatever the statute of repose requires. But my question for you is, going forward, are we going to see a lot of litigation now on the edges between statutes of repose and statutes of limitations, with the plaintiffs arguing that, oh, no, this is a statute of limitation, defendants arguing, no, this is a statute of repose?
Well, we might see some litigation like that. I think what's nice about this decision, between this and CTS v. Waldberger, which are both Kennedy decisions, by the way, there's quite the roadmap put out for other courts to determine whether something is a statute of limitations or a statute of repose. So, for example, if the provision in question runs, it's clear from the text of the provision that it runs from the last action of the defendant, that's going to be a pretty strong indication that it's a statute of repose. If there are two provisions running together, that's going to be a pretty strong indication that one of them is a statute of limitations and the other one's a statute of repose. So, you know, not just for courts, but also for legislatures, if you're, what you're interested in doing is writing a statute of repose, there's a very good roadmap here that the court has given folks for, you know, what you can do to maximize the chances that your statute of repose will be upheld. And so I think that this is a useful and careful decision in that respect. But in terms of policing the line between statute of limitations and statutes of repose, you know, I there might be some litigation there, but I think that there's enough clarity here that there won't be necessarily a need for the Supreme Court to weigh in on that again. Unless we see, lower courts just, as we've seen in, for example, the arbitration context, unless we see lower courts just refusing to accept the court's guidance here.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's check in with our next caller.
Hey, Dean. Hey, Mark. It's Robert Barker in Atlanta calling. How are you guys?
Hey, Bob.
Hey, I was about to ask a question. It's kind of the way Dean was going with that last comment he made, I think. But it seems to me that what the court seems to be holding here is that there's, and maybe, Mark, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that there is no equitable tolling in the statute of repose at all?
That's correct.
So, and I think what Ginsburg's problem with that is that there are some things, like manufacturing or environmental, like the Waldberger case, where we all expect the statutes of repose to be, just because of the passage of time, the manufactured product is out there. But there are some other areas like the securities area, and I'm wondering how this is going to play out in the ERISA context, because it seems to me that there are areas there where intervening human action can actually prevent the cause of action from arising. And I'm wondering if that needs to be thought through in the differences between statutes of repose in various areas of law. I think that's what Dean was getting to, and I'm not sure that this case would necessarily apply in the ERISA context because of the differences in language and purpose.
Well, I do think, Bob, that the court puts down a pretty definitive line here on saying that there wouldn't be equitable tolling for statutes of repose, but at the same time, it acknowledges that statutes of repose in different statutes might be structured differently. So, for example, it says that there might be an explicit exception in the statute to the statute of repose.
Right.
And then it also says that, you know, there could be times when the statute of repose is written in a general way that appears to conflict with, you know, other parts of the statute. And so I think that there would still be room in those sorts of circumstances for the courts to parse that. And even if they didn't call it equitable tolling, there might be equitable considerations that come into play in their statutory interpretation. Not saying that necessarily should be the case, but you might see that. But in terms of a definitive statement by the court that when it's clear to the court that the statute of repose meant to put down a line after which liability would not exist,
mm-hmm.
You could not really ask for better language than what Kennedy provides here in saying that the court does not have power to, or does not have authority, I believe is the word he uses, to alter the legislature's edict in that regard.
No, it's a good case in that regard, but I just wonder whether or not it might lead to some either revised statutory provisions or maybe further litigation.
Definitely possible. And one other thing I was thinking about, maybe this is more in regard to Dean's last question than yours, Bob, but when it comes to product liability litigation where you do have longer statutes of repose, I think 10 years is maybe the plurality in terms of states that have statutes of repose governing product liability cases, that you could imagine that the alternative avenues for relief might be different. One of the things that seemed to be driving the court's decision here in the securities context and in the class action context is that Congress has already weighed in the class action context in particular in the 1990s with some class action reform saying that, hey, if you want to be a non-named plaintiff in the lawsuit, then here's how you do that. And, you know, you don't have to really do that much to protect your rights, and that there may be other places where the court takes a look at it and says, you know, it would be quite difficult to protect your rights under this set of facts that's hard for us to, you know, to predict ahead of time. And you could imagine that the court might bend over backwards to at least consider a different result there. But I have to say, I don't really see a lot in this decision that presages much flexibility.
Thank you.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we wait to see if somebody else might ring in. I'm not sure I have a good hypothetical here, Mark, but on a statute of repose, Robert Barker mentioned sort of an intervening human event. Let's just take the product's liability, for example. I suppose there could be something that happens in that 10-year period by the company, by the manufacturer that they do, that would give rise to an independent cause of action. And I think so if there's a crib manufacturer, there's some sense that there might be a defect and there's an investigation in year 5 and the company affirmatively covers up the findings or the data on the rate of injuries or something like that. The statute of repose might end 10 years later, but that intervening human conduct might give rise to a whole separate cause of action.
It's almost like you're trying to take me back to my days as a Consumer Product Safety Commission, Dean. But I remember crib debates very well. No, I think that's right. Even under the terms of the statute of repose, it runs from the last act or omission of the defendant. And so in the securities context, that last act or omission is going to be, at least if what you're alleging is a material misrepresentation or omission in the registration statement, then it's very clear that the registration statement is the date from which you are going to run that 3-year period. You could imagine to take your example of the crib manufacturing context, you could imagine an act or omission by the manufacturer that post-dated the manufacturing date of the item. For example, you could imagine that the manufacturer received a whole lot of defect reports from customers about the product, and maybe covered them up or didn't do anything with them, didn't notify the CPSC or what have you, and you could imagine different causes of action that might, private causes of action, I mean, not the CPSC taking action, but private causes of action that might extend or that might cause, the statute of repose might run from that last act or omission is what I'm really trying to say, rather than from the original manufacturing date of the product.
Right.
So it's not so much that it tolls the statute of repose, it just changes the beginning run date. Yeah.
Good. Oh, well, it looks like we have had our final question, but let me revert to you once again and see if you have a final thought or want to do something by way of wrapping up, Mark Chenoweth.
Well, thanks, Dean, and I appreciate that. I guess what I would say is that some folks have been calling this a boring term at the Supreme Court, and from my perspective, that really hasn't been true at all. There are a number of what you might think of as relatively technical questions that the court has tackled this term, and this case would be among them. But these are important questions that the court doesn't always take the time to consider when it has a bunch of blockbuster cases on the docket. And my hope is that the court, having had a term like this, will realize that it doesn't hurt to take some of these cases and decide these issues. And in fact, does a lot of good for markets and for market participants. And so I am thrilled that the court took this case, that it decided the issue correctly, and has provided some clarity for market participants going forward, and I hope that it will, as I say, that it, having done that this last term, that it will perhaps continue to be more likely to grant some of these cases certiorari in the future and decide some of these issues rather than being determined to make it not a boring term by taking some of the other kinds of blockbuster cases that may have wider public interest but may not have as much of an effect on the markets and market participants as cases like this one do. So that would be my final thought. And Dean, thank you for the opportunity to participate in the teleforum on CalPERS v. ANZ Securities, Inc.
Well, thank you to Mark Chenoweth on my behalf, but also on behalf of the Federalist Society. I also want to thank the audience for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled teleforum conference call tomorrow at noon. We'll be talking about one more decision of the Supreme Court from this term, Murr versus Wisconsin, tomorrow at noon, this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.